ای فدای آن همه عطر و بوی تو، هر زمان دل می کشد پر به سوی تو، هر کجا پا می نهم سر فرود آرم، قبله‌گاه من شده خاک کوی تو.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nad Hashimi, who is a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and the co-editor of a new book, The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nad Hashimi.
Happy to be with you.
And the P5+1, a meeting in Baghdad with the Iranian delegations prior to it, the head of the IAEA, Mr. Amano, said that things look good. He'd had a meeting in Tehran. And apparently the six powers, that's the five permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany, have put forward a detailed proposal aimed at curbing Iran's nuclear program. Any news that you've heard from your contacts in Iran?
No. I mean, this is the first stage of substantive negotiations that really speak to core issues separating the West from Iran on the question of Iran's nuclear program. Press reports are indicating that both sides have brought proposals to the table that deal with many of the core outstanding and critical issues at the core of this conflict. And it remains to be seen whether there is room for common ground to resolve this issue. As you indicated, going into these talks in Baghdad, just yesterday, the head of the IAEA, Yukiya Amano, came forward and said that a tentative deal had been reached between Iran and the International Atomic Energy Association that would allow for very intrusive inspections of Iran's nuclear program, including some of those military sites that are suspected to be producing or testing nuclear weapons or technology that could lead to the production of nuclear weapons. So that seems to indicate that there's been a shift in policy and a possibility here that there could be some serious progress in resolving this issue.
Well, according to the Associated Press, an unnamed Iranian official said that the Iranian delegation have put forward a package of five items based on the principles of step-by-step and reciprocity. Now, we know that they want the sanctions to end and they don't want this new round of sanctions that starts in July to happen. I understand that was their first request, and I believe the P5+1 said that's a non-starter.
That's correct. That's my understanding as well. I think the Iranians are going to, make demands, understandably, in the first round that I think we shouldn't expect are going to be accepted by the other side. It really, I think, is going to depend on whether there is room for compromise and sort of revisiting both proposals to find some common ground. I mean, what's interesting here, at least from my perspective, is, what seems to be a clear shift in willingness on the part of Iran to now negotiate and to consider a new policy that could perhaps meet the minimum demands that the West has been placing on Iran. And the big question will be whether there can be any common ground in a final set of agreements where both sides can sort of come out of this looking like they have not caved in and that they both can claim victory to their own constituencies.
Again, I'm speaking with Nad Hashimi, who's a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver and the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. And in terms of the sites that the IAEA were denied entry a while back to a military site that's considered suspicious, any indications that they're going to be more forthcoming? What was behind the head of the IAEA's optimism?
Well, that's a good question. I think the only rational conclusion is that those controversial sites, such as the Parchin site military complex outside of Tehran, and there's another one outside of the city of Qom, which have been off limits from an Iranian perspective. It seems now that Iran is open and willing to allow external scrutiny and observation of those sites. Had that not been the case, then Mr. Omano, the head of the IAEA, I think would not have made the statements that he did yesterday. So it remains to be seen exactly, you know, what the details are on that agreement. But I think the statements by the head of the IAEA suggest that there's been a shift and a willingness on the Iranian part to allow for greater international scrutiny and inspection of its nuclear sites. So that, I think, signifies a shift. And fundamentally, I think all of this is positive because it diminishes the possibility of a military strike and an ensuing war on the region, which would be catastrophic.
Well, most of the talk of military strikes have come from Israel. And, of course, recently President Obama said there's been far too much loose talk about war with Iran. And, of course, he's trying to dampen down the rise in the price of oil, which has, I think, accompanied much of these threats. But my understanding is that the Iranians don't necessarily take the threats that seriously. And I don't know whether the U.S. behind the scenes have given them the impression that they are not on board with these threats. What's your sense? I mean, we had the U.S. ambassador in Israel recently basically saying that the U.S. was all on board these Israeli plans to attack Israel. But, you know, that may have been for the domestic audience. What's your understanding about how credible and how seriously the Iranians take the Israeli threats?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think no one really knows because, you know, to answer that question, one would have to get into the minds and the inner circle of Iran's ruling oligarchy, which is a very small, narrow group of clerics centered around Iran's supreme leader. Officially, the position of the Iranian regime is that they don't take these threats seriously, that this is bravado, this is talk. I think what the Iranian regime does take much more seriously are the economic sanctions, which, if they continue, are going to seriously erode the viability of the Iranian economy and can seriously hurt the legitimacy and the stability of this regime, you know, looking forward months down the road, years down the road. So I think that's a much more significant factor. With respect to the, you know, the whole question of a military strike, there seems to be an emerging consensus, not only in the United States, but interestingly, even within Israel, there's a big division between the political leadership and the military and intelligence sort of leadership of the State of Israel, that latter group being strongly critical of the talk of war that is coming out of the mouths of Benjamin Netanyahu and his government. There's been a series of statements and an internal sort of debate suggesting that even within Israel, you know, people realize that the talk of a military strike on Iran and a possible war is catastrophic for Israel. So I think, you know, one has to also keep that in consideration. I think the Iranians are sort of, you know, they pick up on these debates and they are aware of it. To what extent they actually take these threats seriously remains to be seen.
So, Nader Hashemi, you mentioned that what is hurting Iran, or at least getting their attention, and perhaps has led to these talks, is the economic squeeze from the sanctions, and the second round of sanctions are apparently really going to bite, and that begins in July. But already there are reports that Iran's using surplus super tankers to store oil, which indicates that their oil is not being sold. What do you understand about the state of the oil market in Iran?
Well, I think it's very fragile. I think the Iranians are clearly worried that, you know, one of its major customers, in this case Europe, which purchases about, you know, 18 to 20% of Iran's oil as of July 1st, will no longer be an option for the Iranians, and that other countries in OPEC are going to be increasing production to fill that void. So I think, you know, the Iranian regime, despite its internal repression and brutality, is very sophisticated and realizing and being able to diagnose future threats and challenges down the road. And it sees that unless there is some sort of attempt at least to resolve the problem with the West over its nuclear program, that it could be in very serious economic straits, a year from now. So I think there is deep fear and deep concern within the Iranian ruling elites and ruling circles over this question, and the best indication of that are the talks that are taking place today in Baghdad and the tentative agreement that was reached with the IAEA just the other day. I mean, the question to ask is, what explains this shift? What explains the rhetoric coming out of Iran that, you know, there is a possibility of now resolving these questions? There's been a clear sort of shift, not a 180-degree shift, I would say perhaps, you know, a 45-degree shift in Iranian policy on this question. And I think that can only be explained by the existing sanctions that are in place and the threat of that might materialize in the coming weeks and months.
You just dropped out there. The threat of something that might materialize. If you could repeat that.
Yes. The threat of more punitive sanctions down the road in the coming months and years. I think that is also a factor that is affecting and shaping Iranian policy over this question. And I think that largely explains why Iran now is willing to negotiate, to present proposals, to entertain proposals, to allow for greater inspection of its nuclear program when, you know, just a month ago, it was not open to such possibilities. So I think the only explanation in the changing rhetoric and the changing attempt by the Iranian regime to try and reach some accommodation with the West is that the fact that its economy, if it continues down the current path, is headed for collapse, and the regime fundamentally wants to survive and wants to prevent that from happening. And so now we're seeing, you know, Iran coming to the bargaining table with an attempt to resolve this issue.
But Nader Hashemi, the other question that comes up, the one that needs to be answered, is why is this Iranian leadership putting this country through this pain? Right. What is worth the sanctions that they've endured for a long time now, the isolation that they've endured? I know they blame the great Satan and the little Satan for everything, but it leads people, and at least in my case, to wonder what it is that's so valued about this nuclear program that they're wanting to put themselves through all this pain. The idea of national pride is not sufficient an answer.
No, it's a very good question, and I think the answer to the question is that this is a regime that is fundamentally motivated by preserving its own existence and perpetuating its rule on power. In that sense, it's not different from other authoritarian regimes. Ideology matters much less than regime survival. And from the perspective of the regime, it feels itself very isolated and prone to possible future attack, thus necessitating the demand or the need for some sort of safety net, some sort of assurance that what happened to Saddam Hussein would not happen to Iran, what happened to Gaddafi would not happen to Iran. And in fact, about a year ago, a little over a year ago, Iran's supreme leader gave a famous speech right after the NATO bombing campaign began against Gaddafi in Libya, where the Iran's supreme leader explicitly said, now I'm paraphrasing, but it's pretty close to his original statement, where he basically said, you know, Gaddafi, you stupid idiot, look what you did, and look what you have, look at the problems that have now, we'll look at the problems that you are facing because you gave up your nuclear program to the West in exchange for an economic relationship with the West and diplomatic relationship with the West, and now you are on the verge of being overthrown. And the point that the Supreme Leader was making is that we will not make the same mistake that Gaddafi made. In other words, the insistence and the stubbornness and the intransigence that the Iranian regime has shown on the nuclear question, I think, is motivated by the deep desire to develop nuclear technology and a capacity that it could then invoke if there was ever a crisis moment where it felt that it might be attacked or it might be the regime might be jeopardized, the survival of the regime might be jeopardized, and so to prevent, in other words, a repetition of events that we saw in Libya or in Saddam Hussein, that's really the motive behind this regime. First and foremost, and second, of course, Iran has aspirations to be a regional power, and it knows that if you join that special club, your regional clout enhances significantly. So I think those are the two motivating factors, and that explains why the regime is going to such extreme lengths to pursue this program. I think that's the explanation that most rationally makes sense to me.
Well, I understand that. You say the Ayatollah, the supreme leader, basically said that, you know, that Gaddafi's a fool and he shouldn't have given up his nuclear program. He lost his leverage, and implying that the Iranians would never do that, this regime would never do that. But on the other hand, the same supreme leader has recently said that nuclear weapons are a sin. Harum, I think it's the word.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, that's the official line of the regime, and I think my explanation for that is that the regime wants to have its cake and eat it too. In other words, it's pursuing a nuclear program that is very similar to what has been described as the Japanese option. In other words, Japan has the nuclear capacity and technology to produce a nuclear weapon if it desires, but it's not actually searching and engaged with the production of a nuclear weapon. So I think Iran wants to have the technology, wants to enrich uranium, wants to have the option, wants to become a nuclear-capable state. But at the same time, it doesn't want to produce a nuclear weapon at this moment. So this way, the Ayatollah can sort of deflect criticism by saying that, you know, from the perspective of Islam's ethical and moral system, it is a sin, it is un-Islamic to obtain a nuclear weapon because these weapons are catastrophic and weapons of mass destruction. But at the same time, Iran wants to produce the capacity and to get that technological know-how. If ever, in a moment of crisis, it needs to produce a weapon, then it can quickly sort of shift gear and it can claim, well, look, the survival of our regime was at stake. We have to sort of, you know, go in this direction. And so I think that really explains the frequent invocation of the supreme leader that Iran doesn't want a nuclear weapon. And its claim that it's not pursuing a nuclear weapon is not sort of something that can be diminished to the Ayatollah himself. A lot of, you know, there's a consensus among senior military leaders in the United States that Iran is not actively trying to produce a weapon, but it's experimenting with technology that would give it the capability to produce a weapon in the future in a moment of crisis. So I think this is allows the Ayatollah to sort of have his cake and eat it too. There's also an added story. About a month and a half ago, there was a report that came out in the 1980s that Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic, decided to pursue research to produce a nuclear weapon. And this was the context of the Iran-Iraq war when Saddam Hussein was using chemical weapons, and it was decided that Iran needed to pursue a nuclear option. And the current supreme leader was there at that meeting and apparently also endorsed and signed off on this project and on this new policy, thus undermining the claim that, you know, obtaining a nuclear weapon is Islamically unforbidden. I think, you know, let's remember that he is first and foremost, I think, a politician more than a religious leader. And so if the needs of state dictate that you need to pursue a nuclear weapon, then you will easily, you know, just shift policy and make a moral justification for why the old policy no longer stands up.
So, Joe, Nad Hashimi, again, the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. It would seem, though, that one would like to know what happened to the Green Movement. Obviously, they were brutally repressed by the Basij militia, which is religiously motivated but still a part of the Revolutionary Guard Corps. It's hard to think of an analogy here in the United States of young religious zealots. If Pat Robinson and Jerry Falwell had Christian vigilantes and armed them,
right?
I mean, it's hard to come up with a comparison. But the long the short of it is, there is obviously support for this regime. And when we always assume that all the young Iranians are all pro the Green Movement and want to get rid of the Ayatollahs, that may be the case in the urban areas, but you know, not necessarily the case all across the country. So, just give us a sense of what's smoldering, and you know, the embers smoldering under the ashes is the analogy that's been used.
Right.
And in the context of Iran having, you mentioned about their regional role, you know, they could have a big reversal by losing Syria, and then that would weaken Hezbollah. So there are some reason to think that the Green Movement could come back.
I mean, those are all really good questions. I mean, the status of Iran's opposition Green Movement now is that it is going through a very difficult phase of its existence. It's basically trying to survive all of its senior sort of political intellectual leadership are either in jail, imprisoned, or in exile. There is an external division of this group that exists abroad. But one of the challenges that you indicated that faces Iran's pro-democracy Green Movement is that it's facing a regime that is very brutal, and this is a regime, as you indicated, that does have a base of support, and has a base of support that is not very wide, but it's a regime that has support that is not very deep, but it is wide. And what I mean by that is that this is a regime that has a group of ideologically zealous followers that believe that the supreme leader is God's representative on earth, and if he gives them command, they are willing to, you know, break a lot of heads and kill a lot of people. And one of the things that has struck me in terms of the recent events in the Arab Spring, one of the lessons to be learned is how all authoritarian regimes do have a certain base of support, and it's very difficult to overthrow an entrenched authoritarian regime simply by nonviolent protests. The lessons of Syria, in other words, here, I think, are instructive in terms of understanding the possibility of a democratic transition in Iran. What do you do when you have a regime that's willing to kill thousands, hundreds of thousands, perhaps more, to stay in power? And, you know, there is that element within Iran that believes that they have God on their side, and they're willing to shed a lot of blood to retain power. So I think these are sort of challenges that are facing the Green Movement. The Green Movement also has internal sort of ideological challenges in the sense that officially the leadership of the Green Movement is not in favor of revolution. It's in favor of a reform of the existing system. And that is a very controversial and divisive sort of question. But I think it's one that, you know, Iranian Green Movement supporters are going to have to work out among themselves. But I think the desire and the hunger, as you indicated, for political change in Iran is very deep, is very widespread. There's a long history of pro-democracy activism in Iran going back over 100 years. And unfortunately, this regime has been able to immunize itself somewhat from the domestic desire for political change by constantly playing up the possibility of an external Israeli or American military strike on its territory. The nuclear question feeds into the regime's strategy of survival. The nuclear question has been spun by the Iranian regime as a nationalist question that immunizes and sort of gets the regime some support as well. And so there are huge obstacles that I think are facing democratic forces in Iran. I think if we can sort of somehow remove or resolve the nuclear question and remove the possibility of a nuclear strike on Iran, that will create, I think, a more healthy atmosphere that will allow for civil society to perhaps reconstitute itself and allow democratic forces to reconstitute itself. As we know from the Egyptian Revolution and the Tunisian Revolution, there's no predicting when a political change can happen. You know, I'm of the view that if one wants to watch for a particular moment of crisis, you know, the current supreme leader, who is all-powerful, is eventually going to pass away from the scene. When he does die, that will be a moment of huge decision-making and a huge crisis for the regime in terms of who will replace them, the possibility of an opening for democratic forces. But that we'll have to, you know, wait and to see, you know, what transpires on that front.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Nader Hashimi.
Glad to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nader Hashimi, who is a professor of Middle Eastern and Islamic politics at the Joseph Kobel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and the co-editor of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and The Struggle for Iran's Future. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the firing of the head of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
I wanted to walk through the empty streets and feel something constant under my feet, but all the news reports recommended that I